I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
C13 Originals.
Well, when Butch Crouch squared up with somebody, he would put a hurting on you. He would hit you just whatever was available. He hit you with a bottle, a chair, whatever, whatever. It depended on the degree of severity, you know. He was a stand-up guy. He was not something to toy with. And he was very loyal. And you saw the loyalty that he invoked from people from different states, from different cities, different clubs. And then in turn, he would expect the same.
This is Matt Zanaskar. Matt Z was a former president of the Cleveland Hells Angels and a 20-year member. He was retired from the club in 1991. But he's been in a few life or death fights alongside my father. And they were close friends in the 1970s.
He was a Louisiana country boy from down south. I really don't know how he found his way up to Cleveland. But the first time that I recall meeting him, Butch was at Ted's Bar up on Lakeshore Boulevard, right close to the border of Euclid and Cleveland. And I walks in the bar with this other fella, and there's Crouch. He's in a argument with this guy named Paul Horn. Paul Horn was a little bit of a tough guy in that particular far east side of Cleveland. Somewhat of a bully, you know. And anyway, they had an argument evidently, because right when I walk in, they're arguing. And then next thing you know, they pulled guns on one another.
We're singing all day and you can't tame it. High tide, low tide, you know. Night time, morning time, yeah. We're going strong, headed up, down the river. Oh Lord, I feel the reveling. I feel a change on the rise.
Mm-hmm. I'm Jackie Taylor, and this is Relative Unknown. My real name is Jackie Crouch. Jackie Taylor is the name that was given to me by the U.S. Marshals when I was 7 years old and put into the Witness Protection Program. We were relocated, and any ties to the Crouch name were cut off completely. Less than a year later, my father left, and I'd only see him one more time before he killed himself and his wife and stepson in 2013. Since then, I've been trying to fill in the blanks in both of our stories.
You got the white one and the black one. Come on here.
My father was from Shreveport, Louisiana. And like Matt Z said, he was totally country.
Yeah.
And so was his family.
Here they come. Come on. Come on. Woo. Woo. Get your ass in that pen.
Ray's already in there.
Earlier this year, I went to visit my cousin, Trisha Ann Griffith. Trisha's mom was my Auntie Frida, Butch's sister, and my Uncle Harry is her stepdad. Trisha lives in Lucky, Louisiana, and when I arrived, she and her son were trying to get their baby pigs back into the pen.
You done let them out?
They run it out.
Open the gate, Fred.
The gate's open.
Come on.
Y'all stand on the side of that fence in the middle.
There they go, Fran.
Get in there.
Shit,
Shorty.
Got
a
twin in there.
Oh. Stepping
after him.
Round it up, boys.
That's what I'm talking
about.
He'll be out.
Is that where they got out?
Have you lost any?
No, we only got six.
Is there all six in there?
Yeah. Yeah. Because this is actually going to be my chicken coop.
Oh.
Yeah. Sir.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Get up ready.
Thank you for helping us.
Oh, yeah. Well, we'll round them up anytime. I'll bring my horse next time.
Trisha got a fire going, and we sat down next to it to talk.
See, the stories that Mama always told me about Uncle Butch, they was mostly good stories. But now she would tell me that, like, if she got picked on as she got older, you know, and the guys would mess with her or something like that, now she would go and tell him, and he would go and straighten them out. But as far as the violence or anything like that, you know, she didn't say what he did. She just said he took care of it. That was all she told me.
I know she was afraid of his temper.
I never saw the temper. I just saw the good side.
Yeah.
I remember now the houseboat we had.
Mm-hmm.
So we used to have a houseboat when we was growing up off of Toledo Bend. And if I'm not mistaken, I think that's before he went to prison. He stayed on the houseboat because nobody knew where it was and nobody knew where he was, but we did. But then I remember right after he got out of prison, he come and stayed with me for a little bit. He had a new name, but I never called him by the new name. I didn't know no Uncle Paul. All I knew was Uncle Butch. He was like, don't call me that. I'm Uncle. No, you're not.
I asked Trisha Ann if she was ever afraid of what could happen to her after my family was put into the safe house in Florida and placed into the Federal Witness Protection Program.
Me? No. I'm not scared of nothing. I'm sorry. I'm just not. No man, no beast, no nothing. I knock people in the head with frying pans, you know. I'm serious. I'll tell you a story. There was an ex-husband. He hit me. No, mistake. First, I hit him in the head with a glass pan, and it cracked it, bust his head open. Then he got up and hit me again. Then I took the frying pan and knocked him smooth out, and then called the popos to come drag him off. Sorry, you know. So, no, I was not nervous about anybody coming to look for me or anything like that because, Mama had warned us, whatever you do, just be careful what you do and how you do it, because there are people out there that are looking for your uncle, and he might come through us to get to him. And I was like, okay. And then I started hearing the stories, about him killing people and people looking for him. And then people are, looking for us and everything else, And I was like, oh, wait a minute, let me step back here and recognize what's going on here.
I wanted to know more about the way my father grew up. His mother was deaf, and I can remember him teaching me some sign language when I was little. Trisha Ann was my grandmother's favorite.
She made sounds, but she couldn't talk like me and you. She always called me baby. And she'll say, baby, baby. I can understand her because I was around her a lot, but other people couldn't understand her, But that's the way she would talk because she went deaf. If I got the story correctly from what I've understood from Mama, that her and her mama had caught the scarlet fever, and her mama died, and Granny went deaf.
According to an article in the Natchitoches Times, printed on January 18th, 1918, when my grandmother was just 2 years old, it was meningitis, not scarlet fever, which tore through her house. She was one of seven children. Her mother and three brothers died, and my grandmother lost her hearing. She went on to have six children of her own from three different men. and my father, Clarence Addie Crouch, born in 1940, was her oldest. Here, a passage from his manuscript.
After my father died, my mother was left to raise all of us the only way she knew, by walking for miles, from daylight to dark, doing what the deaf people call selling, which is going into any bar and handing out little cards with an alphabet printed in sign language on them. As the deaf community is very clannish, we children were raised in the deaf clubs every weekend, where the jukebox was always turned all the way up, and the sounds of screaming from the parents calling after their children was deafening. The children would scream at each other too. Over the years, I seen my mother come home with a leg so swollen she couldn't walk for 2 days. Other times she was brought home by the police because she'd been robbed or raped or both. Sometimes so beat up that she had to stay in bed for a week. Once, someone threw sand in her eyes, and it caused her not to see for a week. So she took two of us along with her to guide her around while she got enough money for food for us. My grandmother on my father's side hated my mother and tried for years to have all of us children taken away by the courts. So because of this, we went from town to town only with what we could carry in a suitcase, trying to stay ahead of the law and Grandma. Grandma had declared Mama incompetent, and we children were placed in a state home.
By 9 years old, my dad was sent by the juvenile court to an orphanage. And at 10, he was sent to a boys' home. Then he came back and began to earn a reputation.
His first nickname was Lulu. L-U-L-U. Anybody could walk the streets with Lulu for a handle. You'd have some balls.
This is my Uncle Ed. I'd never spoken with Ed until a few months ago, when I tracked him down living in a VA hospital in San Francisco.
He was like a prize fighter or something. He was unbeaten.
Would you consider him a bully or did he?
No. You could call him up to protect you. Everybody just loved the shit out of him. He was like a hero kind of guy.
Uncle Ed is Butch's younger brother. Yeah, and as of this year, his only living sibling.
What was he like as a kid growing up with, like having a guy like that as your brother?
Well, it was wonderful. He turned me on to pot the first time when I was like 15 years old. And we used to go hunting out of the car at night with a flashlight. You light up the deer or the rabbit or whatever, light up their eyes, and they're kind of like frozen in the, and they can't move, so you just shoot them. And he told me how to do that and how to take care of myself and how to. He told me if somebody ever convinces you that they're going to kill you, then just you have to get up first thing in the morning and go kill them. Take them out into just get in your car and drive and drive and drive and back roads and stuff and just until you don't know where you are. And then bury them as deep as you can, and then you don't even know where they are. So you can't betray yourself. Listen, I'm going to get off the phone for a little while. I need to take a little nap.
As bizarre and disjointed as my Uncle Ed's memories of my father were, they helped to paint a picture of a teenager with no guidance, beginning down a path toward a life of violence. And sure enough, this article from the Houston Press, printed in 1959, was in my father's trunk.
A 19-year-old high school student accused of stabbing another youth after making sure the victim had no weapon was caught by police. Jailed after a brief chase was Clarence Lulu Crouch, who has a record of 2 previous arrests. Crouch was charged with assault to murder following a battle in a hallway of an apartment building in which 19-year-old Ben Ellison was critically stabbed. Young Ellison told police Crouch had crashed a party the night before and was thrown out by Ellison. He said Crouch threatened to get him, and at midnight the following night, he showed up at Ellison's apartment accompanied by 5 friends. The gang forced Ellison into the hallway to be sure he didn't have a weapon, police were told, and the friends circled the victim to be sure he didn't escape. Then Crouch drew a knife and stabbed him. Ellison is still in a hospital recovering from 2 deep stab wounds. In jail, Crouch refused to say anything.
My dad was charged with assault to murder with malice, and he was given a sentence of 2 to 5 years in prison in Huntsville, Texas. And this is where he begins his story on the very first page of his manuscript, Hate and Discontent. These are his first words.
If someone were to ask how I got involved in motorcycle gangs in the first place, I guess the answer would be that it all started in the Texas prison. About 6 months before I got out in October of 62, the guy in the next bunk noticed it first and snapped me to it. We were on the Wind Farm just outside of Huntsville, which was just off the highway. Our bunks were right next to the window, and we could hear and see this guy on a Harley as he went back and forth to work each day. He had some real nice pipes on that old hog, and the sound would echo across into the window. It sounded like he was talking to us. The sound of freedom as he would get on it all the way down the highway. Every day we would be there at 6 a.m. and 5 p.m. listening at the window. When I got out, I made a promise to myself that I wasn't going back like everybody else. I got the 5 years for assault to murder because I had cut up this guy named Benny Ellison at a party one night. But everybody in the joint seemed to be there for the same thing: robbery, dope, burglary, and checks. But all the time I was there, I only knew two guys who were in the joint for pimping. So I started running as many whores as I could find, which Houston was full of them, and it was nothing to find some dirty leg in a bar. Buy her some clothes and spot her in a hotel downtown with the same old promise of her working long enough to get enough for us to open a bar. I ran 17 whores out of one house. Made a lot of money, but damn if I know what happened to it. I had one hell of a good time blowing all that money, though. Then, one day a cop car came sliding in the driveway and two cops in plain clothes came out with guns. I ran through the house and out the back door as they came in the front. They started shooting into closets and anywhere else they thought I was hiding. When I got to my car, their car was blocking mine in. So I just jumped in their car and hit it north. I stopped in this gas station and paid this guy to take me to Shreveport. After this, I got me a 49 pan chopper, and I never wore a suit again unless I was in court. I let my beard grow and started only riding motorcycles.
Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Do you wake up in a cold sweat from your work dreams?
Have a coworker who keeps inviting you to do escape rooms?
Can't get a coworker to agree to do escape rooms?
Or are you just genuinely not sure how to take the next step in your career?
I'm Kate.
And I'm Kim. And together we run Amy Poehler's company, Paper Kite Productions.
We've been friends and colleagues for years, so we know how important it is to feel like someone has your back at work.
And we want to be that for you.
So we're hosting a weekly advice show where we answer all your work-related questions.
Something amazing happened. I got offered my dream job.
How am I supposed to bring this up to him without hurting his feelings? What should I do?
I want to, like, skip the pleasantries without being an asshole.
Careful, money and friends, they don't mix, babes.
They don't. And don't work with your friends, make your friends at work.
All right, I can't believe I'm going to say this, but that was actually $1 million advice.
Whether you need advice or just love to listen to other people's problems, this show is for you.
Listen and follow Million Dollar Advice, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Why don't you people go home? Get out of here, you possum!
Just throw it.
The voice you hear screaming for people to go home belongs to Ralph Sonny Barger.
Get out of here!
Sonny is a legendary founding member and former longtime president of the Oakland Hells Angels. Here, it's 1965 and the Vietnam War was raging. Sonny and a small group of angels are breaking up a Vietnam War protest in Oakland. Five of them were arrested, and later, Sonny held a press conference where he read a letter he'd sent to President Johnson.
President Lyndon B. Johnson, 1600 Pennsylvania Ave, Washington, D.C. Dear Mr. President, on behalf of myself and my associates, I volunteer a group of loyal Americans for behind-the-line duty in Vietnam. We feel that a crack group of trained guerrillas could demoralize the Viet Cong and advance the cause of freedom. We are available for training and duty immediately. Sincerely, Ralph Barger, Hell's Angels, Oakland, California.
If the 1960s were about counterculture, nobody was more counter to the culture than Sonny Barger and the Hell's Angels. They were welcome to an acid party with Ken Kesey and his merry band of pranksters, and they provided security for the Grateful Dead. Here, Geraldo Rivera speaks with Jerry Garcia.
They aren't the 4-H Club, and they aren't the Boy Scouts of America. The Hell's Angels are a motorcycle club that is generally known as an outlaw motorcycle club and that has had numerous brushes with the law. Does any of those kinds of things affect the way you feel about them?
No, because I'm sort of an outlaw space myself, you know what I mean? I'm no heavy-duty outlaw, but, you know.
Are you afraid of them ever?
Sure. Sure.
Why?
Because they're scary, man. You know, they're all big, you know, and strong and good at, in all the violent spaces. You know, they got that covered, you know. I mean, scary is what one of the things Hell's Angels are.
The bike rider is Cliff Workman, treasurer of the Hell's Angels, the wildest bunch of outlaws to come out of the West since Billy the Kid. He's here to challenge his biographer, a tense young literary journalist named Hunter Thompson.
Author Hunter S. Thompson was as counterculture as it got, and he'd launched his career in 1967 with the book about the Hell's Angels. This audio is from a television appearance that year where Cliff Workman, an original Oakland member, rode his bike into the studio and then had words with Thompson about why the club had a falling out with him.
All right, this man here, you got into a man's personal argument.
That's an outright lie.
No, it ain't. This is my side of what happened.
Okay, you weren't there, so why don't you preface it with that?
This is what happened. Junkie George was beating his old lady.
Junkie George?
Now, this is what happened. Junkie George was beating his old lady.
I remember
Junkie's
that.
George, right. Junkie right. George's dog. Now, listen to this. Junkie George's dog bit him, right? To me, this is a personal fan. This is a personal feud. If a guy wants to beat his wife and his dog bites him, that's between the three of them, right?
Thank you. You're right. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Here came the peacemaker, right? He doesn't have a patch on. He isn't in the club, you know. And Junkie George is stiff. You walked right up to him and you said, "Only a punk beats his wife and dog." And you backed up.
You finished.
And he said, "Hunter, you want some of this?" And you said no, but you got it anyway. And when he hit you, three or four others of them hit you too.
Workman's appearance may have reinforced the media's image of the anti-establishment, antisocial biker, but he also had a clear message for anybody listening, one that riders like him all feel.
See, actually, there are none of us that care what anybody thinks. I don't give a damn. If they don't like me on my motorcycle, it's too bad.
A lot of us have always loved the anti-hero. And you love the power. You love the strength. And the more rules that some of us are handed, the more we like to push back.
Bill Hayes has been riding motorcycles since 1965. And he's one of the most prolific authors on the biker culture, with titles like The One Percenter Encyclopedia and American Biker. The history, the clubs, the lifestyle, the truth. And Hayes says there's three main things that draw people to a motorcycle club.
The attitude and the machine can be one, really, because, you know, if motorcycles were for everyone, everyone would be riding one, and they're not, and they don't. So you have those two things kind of coalescing, the attitude and the machine. And it feels really good to jump on a bike and just go for some people. Others, they're scared to death. When you're talking about the group, now you bring a third feeling into the mix. Now you bring camaraderie into the attitude and the machine. And that camaraderie, there's nothing like it. It's not a family you're born into. It's a family you've earned your way into. And so it's in many ways stronger than blood. And the Pat represents that brotherhood. And it is sacred.
Just to give you a sense of the importance of the patch to my father, it was written in his manuscript 421 times. The first patch he wore after prison was with the Rodbenders, then the Grim Reapers. Then, in 1966, he was a founding member of the Bandidos Motorcycle Club in Houston. While Butch was riding around the South building Bandidos charters, the Hells Angels, behind Sonny Barger, were expanding across the country, both in numbers and reputation. In 1969, the Hells Angels were invited to a free concert at Altamont Speedway in Northern California. They were allegedly given $500 worth of beer and access to the stage. The Rolling Stones were headlining, and during their set, things in the crowd got violent.
Pete, will you do it? And I'll try and stop it. Hey, people, sisters, brothers and sisters. Come on now. That means everybody just cool out.
As Mick Jagger tried to calm the crowd, an 18-year-old man named Meredith Hunter was stabbed to death by an angel.
Is there an officer? What happened here anyway?
Yeah, he pulled out a gun.
He did?
Yes. The Hells Angels took the gun away from him. One of them has it now. He showed it to me. Uh-huh. And they proceeded to put him down on the ground and start kicking him. And he has a couple stab wounds in his back and one over his ear. Tried to keep him alive, and when we got here, the doctor checked him out, and that was it.
Pronounced him dead, and it was funny.
Hunter was brandishing a gun, so the angel was acquitted on self-defense. But the scene, and the aftermath, was made famous in the Maisel Brothers documentary, Gimme Shelter. Later that night, Sonny Barger called into a local radio station to speak his piece.
Mick Jagger had the people sit down. Well, you know what? You grab on Mick Jagger and ask him who told him to tell the people to sit down.
I
told him to tell the people to sit down. And if anybody was there in the front rows can remember me walking over and telling them, you know what? If you tell these people to sit down and be cool, the people in the back can see a little bit and this show will get on and we can get it going. And he done it. Like, this Mick Jagger, like, he used us for dupes, man. You know, and as far as I'm concerned, we were the biggest suckers for that idiot that I can ever see.
Some called what happened at Altamont the end of the age of free love, and it forever tied the Angels to the 1960s. By that point, my father had already turned in his Bandidos patch and moved out to San Francisco to live with his brother, Ed. He traveled out there with the goal of becoming an angel. And after spending a year getting to know the members, he wrote that he was finally brought to Sonny Barger's house in Oakland to meet the man himself.
Now, Sonny Barger is the kind of guy that has had the same phone number for years. He talks to people all across the states. He writes down all the information he can about clubs and bikers, and he asks all he can about the man in a certain town, how many bikers are in that town, their age, and so forth. And over the years, he keeps up with different clubs and their members. We got into the garage and Sonny started telling me that he had heard a lot about me over the last few years, which blew my mind because I was in complete awe of this man anyway. To me, he had been the one that started everything that I had believed in for years. He was like a god of some kind to me and a lot of people. To have him tell me that he knew all about me for years was something else. Then he told me that a bunch of Cleveland brothers had been put in jail for killing two people in a bar called Bardo's Cafe just a few years after they got their charter. He wanted me to go to Cleveland and help rebuild the Hells Angels there. He said that if we took our time and we were cool, we could build something that couldn't be broken apart. He told me all we had to do was be true to the patch and put it before ourselves because Hells Angels was something bigger than all of us.
I'm Lauren Sherman, the writer behind Puck's Fashion and Beauty Memo line sheet, and I'd like to welcome you to my new show, Fashion People. On every episode of Fashion People, I'll be talking to insiders about the stuff we're all whispering between the press releases, from M&A rumors to celebrity stylist dish to the future of legacy media. Be sure to follow and listen to Fashion People, a presentation of Odyssey in partnership with Puck, available on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. Once my dad got to Cleveland, he quickly got his Hell's Angel patch. He began rebuilding the charter there and became the club's vice president. To keep the charter strong, they needed to prevent other clubs from getting stronger in Ohio. And in 1971, an ongoing feud with an MC called The Breed was coming to a head. According to my father, the Angels were discussing The Breed in their weekly meetings, which they called church.
We had been doing a lot of talking in church about The Breed and what to do about them. We found out that they had come to Ohio and set up charters in Akron and on the west side. Then a cop car pulled in front of the clubhouse one day and told us they had word that The Breed were going to attack us at this bike show coming up. The man said that over 100 of them were supposed to show up. We were going to sell bumper stickers saying, "Support your local Hell's Angels," and we had already rented some space at the hall, so there was no way we weren't going to the show. I figured all the out-of-town Breed members would be staying somewhere in the same house together, and they would be suckers for a couple chicks. So I sent my girl Hillbilly and her friend Lee, and they were snatched up by them at the bar and taken to this apartment for 2 days. When they came back, they were screaming about wanting to go back and poison every motherfucker in that apartment. They said that they were talking about some big meeting they had where they were going to go to a bike show and weren't leaving until they stripped all of us of our patches. During our next church, we talked about throwing grenades in the windows of the apartment, or sending the girls over there with poison, or hitting them with machine guns. But the theme of the whole meeting became that we were going to go in there as men and not go sneaking around and shooting them in the back like the punk shit that we expected them to pull. We decided to put out word to all the other charters for as many members as we could get to come to the bike show. Groover told me that he and a few other guys like Vinny were coming in from New York. When Groover got to Cleveland, I took him down to this shop where the owner had a knife sharpening business, and he put a good edge on my buck knife. He told me that the knife was too sharp and only good for cutting meat. Me and Groover laughed and said, "That's all we use a buck knife for anyway."
It was Saturday, March 6th, 1971, and my dad, along with about 26 other Angels members, headed down to a building called the Polish Women's Hall, which was the site of the motorcycle show. Matt Zanaskar, who you heard at the beginning of this episode, was a hanger-on at the time, trying to prove himself worthy of joining the club. He and another hanger-on arrived at the same time as my dad did with Groover.
We all four of us show up at the same time at the door. Crouch acknowledges me and my friend. I'm basically a nobody. You know what I'm saying? Me and my friend, we're nobodies. We are walking in, and all of a sudden, you see wall-to-wall Breed. So whatever minute conversation there was about, hey, there may be some trouble or this or that, never would you expect it to be so wall-to-wall.
We could see nothing inside but Breed patches. At the door, there was a cop, and he was telling everyone that they had to leave their sticks and clubs there with them. These couple of Breed were telling him that there was no way they were going to leave their knives with him. And if he wanted them, then he should try to take them off their legs where they had these scabbards. But the cop was uptight and looking all around for help and then just said, "Go on." We just blew by him yelling at the Breed to get the fuck out of the way because Hell's Angels were coming through.
There were about 800 people inside the Polish Women's Hall and just a handful of policemen. Mike Dugan was one of them.
We were called in to go to Polish Women's Hall with two or three other cars, which would be six, possibly as many as eight officers. And this is supposed to be a motorcycle show for the Hell's Angels. It always is. The Breed was told not to show up. All of a sudden, they walked in mass.
Groover leaned over and said, "Bro, we better get down by that stage where everyone else is because I see some Breed here from up in our area. And they want me bad." We had to plow our way down the aisle through all these Breed. So as I was pushing them to the side, they would turn around and see us, then start looking behind us to see how many more there was behind them. I started yelling over my shoulder to Groover, "The cops are gonna shit when Sonny and all those Hell's Angels from California start coming in. I don't know how 200 Hell's Angels are gonna fit in here." Groover picked up on it and was echoing me as we went along, yelling the same thing over and over, back and forth to each other. We could hear the breed that we passed saying to each other, "Did you hear what he said? There's 200 more Hell's Angels outside coming in here. And Sonny Barger is here too."
But there wasn't any help on the way. Butch was trying to gain whatever mental edge he could. He and the Angels were outnumbered by the breed almost 7-1.
I was positioned at the back closer to the doors. And there was that sense, you know, that it's always hard to describe, but you know it when you feel it, that underlying tension, that like all of a sudden the temperature of the room has went down 40 degrees.
Crouch had some words for someone that was giving him the bad eye. He told me, he says, "Why don't you give me some fucking head?" So we're walking through there, and there was 32 of us all together. You know, I think it was three or four of us that were hangarounds. And this one cop that was there, he was counting them as the breed were coming in. They were taking a head count. There was 205. And we walked through that crowd to get to where we wanted to be with basically our own people, you know, to see what the hell's going on there.
We got up next to the stage, and our president, Freddie, said, "We better get it, because if they get it started, we ain't gonna stop them." So he said, "Pass the word. We go in 1 minute. Fuck these motherfuckers." I took a couple steps back and, with my head to the breed, looked all up and down the line as word reached everyone. I caught Groover's eye, and he made a little fist like pulling out from his chest, and there was a sign we made to each other of "catch you later." To the left of me was Matt and Whitey, who were about the same size at 5'10" and about 180 pounds, but they both were built real solid and powerful. Both of them were just leaning back against the stage with their arms crossed and looking relaxed. I heard Freddie say, "Okay, let's get it," real low. And then he picked up this 2x4-foot sign that said Harley Davidson. And as he threw it at him, he yelled, "Fuck the breed." As the sign was coming down on these breed with a loud crash, I turned around and knocked this one guy out cold as he was looking up at the sign flying through the air. I'd always heard these fights called rumbles, but I never knew the reason till that moment. When all those motorcycle boots start stomping on that wooden floor, it started rumbling through that hall like thunder. The sound kept growing louder and louder until I expected lightning to crack at any moment. Plus, there was this real loud, high-pitched noise that I could feel almost vibrating in my head, which turned out to be an electric guitar that was dropped by the guitar player when the fight broke out, and it landed on the amp. So all the time the fight was going on, there was this real loud whine from the speakers on the stage that was vibrating that whole place.
There was a member there from Oakland. He didn't know who I was. He broke a chair over my back, a wooden chair, that brought me to my knee, but I jumped up, you know. There was a handful for everybody. You didn't want to take your focus off what was in front of you or to the side of you. It was self-defense combat as best as you could do. Punching, kicking, whatever you could do. You know, in fact, the chair that Russell got me with, I ended up using that on a couple people. And then I noticed Groover, he hits the floor. I grab him, I drag him out of that inferno when the shit's getting down, and I just drag him and put him up against the stage, and I see he's starting to turn pale, and I went back into the brawl.
At first, the breed were backing up, and we were charging into him. I punched this one guy that looked real young, and I knew I caught him good, and he was out. But as I turned to my right and punched another one out of the corner of my eye, I could still see this young guy standing. As I turned to hit him again, I seen something coming down at me from over him. And at the same time, I threw up my left hand and seen that it was a knife with one of those long, double-edged blades. It went between my fingers, and the force of it drove my hand back down to my chest, and the blade went in right over my heart. But my hand was against my chest, holding it from going in all the way. And the kid fell to the side, and I seen this guy about 35 standing there. He had been holding up the kid in front of him by the back of the kid's collar. As the kid fell to the floor and out from between us, the guy stepped towards me and grabbed my left shoulder with his left hand, trying to drive the knife into my heart. He was about my size, and we were eye to eye, and our faces were only inches apart. He had this grin on his face, and he said, "Die, motherfucker, die." I had never even thought of pulling my buck knife up to this point, and that's all I remember doing was just thinking about it, and it was there in my right hand. The guy was pulling himself up as he was trying to pull the knife down into me. His eyes were above mine now, and I was pushing with all my might up with my left hand. I hit him below the belt with my buck and pulled up. I thought I missed him because there was no drag on my knife. And then as we were looking at each other's eyes, I seen his expression change. He started slipping down below my eye level, and I said, "Oh yeah, motherfucker, you die. You die." At the same time, I pushed his knife back out of my chest, and he slid down with his eyes still looking up at me, and then rolling up and glazing over. My legs were all wet, and I seen it was blood. The smell coming up as his guts fell out and spilled down between us is when I knew I didn't miss him. That smell was all over me. I just went nuts then, and I started slashing everyone with a breed patch around me. I was about 20 feet away from any member, and in the middle of all of these breed when I felt this pain in my back and seen nothing but a white flash in the floor when I fell. I was lying on my stomach and my arms were under me. I could hear someone saying, "Get his patch." I didn't know it at the time, but I was stabbed in the spine and was paralyzed from the waist down, so all I could move was the top half of my body. As I tried to get the knife ready to slash out at the guy pulling on my patch, I heard him say, "He's still fucking alive." And then another voice say, "Kill him and hurry up and get his patch." I drew my arm back, and at the same time, he drew back the knife in his hand. We hit each other at the same time. He hit me in the chest right next to the other stab wound over my heart. And I hit him in the left side, and that buck went all the way in. And he let out a ooh as he fell over me, at the same time pulling the buck out of my hand and leaving his in my chest. I pulled it out, and blood started pumping out of the hole. I looked out, and there was all this blood running real slow across the floor.
Butch took a couple of knife wounds. One in the back is what really hurt him. And he gutted some guy. He stuck the knife in, and as he was going down, he kept driving that knife up into the chest cavity of the guy in front of him. There was a lot of blood. There was a lot of blood. And the whole thing, it seems to me that it happened so fast. So fast and with such intensity. There was people laying around, the breed laying around, people hobbling, crawling. Breed were retreating. They were running out of the hall. So I bolted out the door and I got the car and I brought it over and we loaded up some people and we got the hell out of there.
The Cleveland Plain Dealer reported, quote, "Dead and injured were scattered about the floor, and cyclists were pouring out of the building trying to escape. Nearby, on Marble Avenue," it read, "patrolman Mike Dugan was pointing a rifle at a 20-year-old Akron man. He tried to kill me," said Dugan. Here again is Mike Dugan.
There was blood all over the place, blood in the street as they were flooding out, and I had seen one individual bend over and his jacket right up enough to see that there was a large hunting knife. I grabbed him and threw him up against the telephone pole, and he was considerably larger than I, and he broke loose. And then I gave foot chase right across the street from Polish Women's Hall, and there was an alley. When he ran in there, I saw him turn around and I saw a motion and I saw the arm come down and then I saw the knife go past me a couple of feet.
The man, a member of the breed, had turned around and thrown his hunting knife at Officer Dugan.
I saw the knife thrown. So what I did is, and today I'd be against departmental policy, I fired a warning shot over his head and he then surrendered and became compliant and, one of the things I have to get in here is one of the few times in my 28 years with the Cleveland Police Department, they called a citywide alert. And that's any car available citywide in all the six districts or traffic or any units. Go to Broadway and Marble, a large gang fight. And they had brought in paddy wagons from the six districts, and I remember them just packing them with, you know, arrest. It was just crazy. Policemen, I've never seen so many. We probably wound up with close to 100 officers there.
The brawl made national news with headlines like Slaughter on Broadway and Worst Gang Battle in U.S. Five members of the Breed were killed. Just one Hell's Angel was stabbed to death. Groover, from the New York chapter. 85 arrests were made, including 10 Hell's Angels indicted on first-degree murder charges, one of whom was my father. Shortly after the brawl, Matt Z asked to become a prospect with the club. And then later that year, he became a brother.
You're involved in this Polish Women's Hall brawl. You see people taking care of their own people. Brotherhood in the raw, as far as having someone's back, brothers taking care of their brothers, okay? You feel that energy. And it's a culmination of all those things, that you can even survive something like that. And laying there is Groover. You know, he paid the ultimate price. When you witness something like that and are part of it, because you would give your own life if you need to, you want to belong to that energy that you experienced. Because those colors are that man. See? As a member of the Hells Angels Motorcycle Club, you are that death head that's on your back. You are representing that, and it represents you. Angels forever, forever angels.
My dad had a lot of tattoos I never understood. Lulu was one of them. I always thought that it was the name of a woman, not an earlier nickname. But now I also understand where another tattoo on his arm came from. It read, "May the earth turn into a ball of shit and be stepped on and turned into dried dog shit dust if your name is forgotten. Yeah, Groover." And by the way, the word dried was spelled D-R-Y-E-D.
The next time I saw Butch was in the county jail, and he was in a wheelchair, and he's smoking a joint. And I says, "Hi, man." I says, "There is nothing on the street right now. How the hell you got that?" He says, "You want some of this?" He says, "Walk down that hallway and punch that cop in the face, and you can come here and we'll share it with you."
Next time on Relative Unknown.
From now on, we would make our own rules up as we went along and fuck the world.
The Angels put themselves on law enforcement's radar during Cleveland's most violent era.
So this war began for control, and bombs were a frequent weapon of choice throughout this conflict.
I was saying over and over to myself, "God, don't let that be something we did."
It was a wild period of time in Cleveland, totally out of control.
Without the light, oh, the darkness comes. Hold through the night, the shadows will run.
Relative Unknown is a creation and presentation of C13 Originals, a division of Cadence 13, and Rumor Inc. Executive produced by Chris Corcoran, Zach Levitt, David Balinson, Michael Galinsky, and Suki Holly. Written, produced, directed, and edited by Zach Levitt. Produced and edited by Perry Kroll. Our theme song is Change on the Rise by Avi Kaplan. Original music composed by Joel Goodman. Mixed and mastered by Bill Schultz. Production support by Ian Mont and Lloyd Lockridge. Field recording by Rich Berner, Michael Galinsky, Perry Kroll, and Connor Waddingham. Production engineering and coordination by Sean Cherry and Terrence Malingone. Artwork, marketing, and PR by Kurt Courtney, Josephina Francis, and Hilary Schuff. I'm Jackie Taylor, and thanks for listening to Relative Unknown.
I feel a change on the rise. I feel a change on the rise.
They said it couldn't be done. They say it bordered on impossible.
When someone says I can't do something, I usually agree with them.
And now, against all odds, this completely mediocre comedy podcast has done the unthinkable. They got listeners.
We got listeners.
No way.
Amazing.
Now available on the Odyssey app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm so happy we're at Odyssey now.
Oh my God, they're amazing.
The Commercial Break Podcast. You heard it here last.